Thank you, Will. Good afternoon, everyone. Bonjour. I'm Ken White, and I am a member of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada Board of Trustees. I am also a recovering journalist, or as the mayor says, now a fully realized human being, employed as Senior Vice President of Public Policy at Rogers Communications. I have been on the McGill board, the Institute board, for 12 of its 20 years now, and one of the things we've always been very conscious of is representing the whole of Canada, so it was really a treat for me to see a fellow Albertan, Mayor Nenshi, giving the keynote speech here this afternoon. I thought he did a wonderful job. He really is a remarkable storyteller, especially for an academic, and I think you got a really good sense of why people think he's one of the more intriguing new political personalities in Canada. We are here today with a panel that I'd like to invite up on stage to join us to discuss a topic very germane to what Mayor Nenshi was speaking about on individuals, communities, and global civil society. We have four people here representing the worlds of business, journalism, arts, and community leadership, and I'll introduce them in alphabetical order, after which I will ask them each to speak to you individually for 5 minutes before we open the conversation. And towards the end of the conversation, I will take some questions from the audience via Twitter. We are at hashtag Canada Remix, so I encourage you all to get your questions in. Joining me on stage are Bertrand Sesvet, chairperson and senior partner at Sid Lee, an international creative services agency headquartered in Montreal. John Ibbotson, Globe and Mail journalist, my former colleague, former chief political correspondent, and the author most recently of The Big Shift. We have Professor Ken Lum, artist and University of Pennsylvania professor, a native of British Columbia, and last but not least, chairperson of the National Committee on Inuit Education and former president of the Inuit Circumpolar Conference, Mary Simon. Please welcome our panel. Mr. Sesvet, let's begin with you. Your thoughts on the theme of individuals, community, and global civil society.
Well, thank you very much. Listen, I'm really happy to be here. I realize I came to school here. That was a long time ago. That was like 30 years ago. And I realized I'd never been in this room. It's a beautiful room. Somehow, I don't know why. But when I finished my studies in economics, my final paper was I asked my colleagues in class, and you know, it was the Cold War back then. I asked them, you know, what's the future of mankind? And you know, the answer was always, well, you know, there's going to be a nuclear holocaust. You know, we're all going to die. You know, and the end of the world is coming. And then I would ask them a couple of, you know, stupid questions, and then I would ask them another question, which is, you know, in a few weeks you're going to graduate, and what are you going to do? And the answer was, well, I'm going to look for a job, I'm going to get married, and I'm going to have kids. So there was always this amazing disconnect between, you know, the individuals and their relationship to the environment and the collectivity they live in. So after that, basically, you know, I did the only sensible thing I could think about. I went to advertising. and I've decided, basically, that I would solve the world's problem one ad at a time. However, you know, when I continued my career in advertising, although it looks completely disconnected to my opening statement, what I've been doing for the past, you know, 20 years is probing the human soul, probing, you know, Canadians and probing people all over the world to understand their motivation and their relationship between individualism and their sense of belonging to civil society and to communities at large. And you know what I've come to realize is that there is an overwhelming sense today that people have changed a lot, and that you know 30 years ago were the good days. Today's basically youth, especially, are not really involved in civil society. They're very apathetic, and you know their sense and their relationship to government is not as strong as it used to be. And what I'm observing nowadays is that simply I think that people are, you know, there are two phenomena. The first thing is I think that Canada as a country, in spite of everything we say, has done fairly well. As we saw in the first presentation, I think that typically people react, and this sense of getting involved with community is typically heightened in the face of crisis, such as a flood or something like that. But when the country is going relatively well, because I'm privileged enough to spend half of my time everywhere around the world, and believe me, I think that Canada has done extremely well, and I think is doing very, very well for the future. What we are lacking right now is leadership, and what we're lacking are big ideas. What we're lacking is something else than response to impending crises, natural crises, the environment. I mean, these are things that get people involved. But what we lack is basically leadership of idea across Canada. However, the good news is what I observe every day as I try to engage with young people around the world is that more than ever, people have a sense that they can solve individually all problems around the world. Last week, I was at a conference in Geneva, and I met a young man who was from India, and he told me, well, you know, we were talking about pollution and the environment. And quite simply, his answer to that was, you know, I'm going to raise $2 billion and I'm going to create a lunar mining company. And I'm going to find, you know, an incredible rock that's going to solve the world's energy, and then we can move on. So I think that, you know, what I like to focus on now is this great sense of optimism and also the importance of looking for big ideas in our society.
Thank you, Bertrand.
Society, which is everything, right? So I'm not going to talk about all of that. I'm just going to talk about The Big Shift, which some of you may have heard of. It's a book that Daryl Bricker and I wrote. And if the theme of today's talk is remixing Canada, what Daryl and I have argued is that Canada is already well down the path of being remixed. We argue in the book that there are two shifts underway in Canada, both very well advanced, and that they are changing the geopolitical reality of the country. We argue that for most of this country's history, we were governed by what we called the Laurentian elites. This would be you, by the way. We argued that from the Confederation until quite recently, the political, business, public service, academic, cultural media elites in the cities along the St. Lawrence watershed, principally Toronto, Ottawa, and Montreal, but we said the watershed so we could get Kingston in, debated among themselves the big issues of the day, whether it was the national policy or conscription, fighting the Depression, conscription, the infrastructure revolution, the social revolution, the question of Quebec aspirations, fighting the deficit, gay marriage. On all the big issues, the Laurentian elites debated the issues among themselves, usually reached a consensus, and implemented that consensus. Quite often through the Liberal Party, because it was the party federally that was most often in government, but provincial, but conservative parties could do in a pinch. There was no prime minister more Laurentian than Brian Mulroney. They governed the country very well. This is an important point, because some people think that the book is an attack on the Laurentian elites. It's not. As we say repeatedly in the book, if you think Canada is a success as a country, and we think Canada is a fabulous country, then we have the Laurentian elites to thank for it, because they ran it. But their influence is in decline, and we think, especially after the last federal election, that decline is now glaringly apparent because of the two big shifts. What are the two big shifts? Well, the first is a shift in power and influence and population to the West. The Laurentian elites never got the West. They never understood the West. They never particularly liked the West. It was far away. It was home to sort of strange populist political uprisings that were, you know, fortunately ephemeral, but it could be largely ignored. Well, it can't be ignored anymore. As you well know, population is shifting to the West. Last year, almost all the job creation that took place in this country took place in Alberta. The last census showed us that there are now more people living in the four western provinces than in Quebec and Atlantic Canada combined. And that shift is continuing, and it will accelerate over time. And now we have, guess what? The first truly Western government in this country's history, from the Western Prime Minister, dominated by Western values and a Western ethos. We think that is reflective of that political shift. And the second shift is the result of the greatest achievement of the Laurentian consensus, which was multiculturalism and immigration. Lester Pearson dropped the color bar and created the point system in the 1960s, and Brian Mulroney increased the quotas, and John Cretchen maintained them in the 1980s and 90s, so that now we bring in more people than any other country on the planet Earth, from more places than any other country on the planet Earth takes people, and we do it year after year after year. We have brought in two Torontos in the last 20 years. We have duplicated this country's largest city twice. And if you do that, you're going to change the politics. And if you fill those two new cities with people from parts of the world who traditionally had not ever been in this country, then the transformation is going to be profound. And that's the second shift. We have found, and this is where Daryl Bricker's contribution is particularly helpful through his polling analysis at Ipsos Reid, we have found that aspirational middle-class suburban immigrants, the millions and millions and millions of people living outside the city of Toronto, living outside Ottawa, living outside Montreal and Calgary, Edmonton, Vancouver, Lower Mainland, but especially the ones living outside the 905, because there are so many of them. They are more economically and they are more socially conservative than most of the native-born. So there is a new coalition emerging, a coalition of aspirational middle-class, especially aspirational middle-class immigrant voters in the big cities outside Toronto and other parts of central and western Canada, and the West. That new coalition is stable, it is permanent, and it will grow over time. It does not mean that the Conservatives are going to win every election. It doesn't. Any election is a crapshoot. But it means that there is an inherent advantage to this new Conservative coalition, and it's one that politically we're going to have to get used to if we're going to understand what's happening in our federal political life. I have 25 minutes more to go, but I think you're going to cut me off.
Thank you, John.
Well, with respect to Mayor Nenshi's speech, which I thought was it's a great speech, I do want to express some contention, which I don't really entirely agree with the mayor, one large component, which is the definition of a Canadian being basically a metric of how much presence the government has in your life. I don't really agree with that. Right? I think that's... I believe in government. I live in the United States where the disbelief in government is you know, dysfunctional. But I also don't believe in that the definition of Canadians is defined by government presence, right? Of course, that shapes the society and so all that. Because what's missing is something that Bertrand was just relating to, which is, you know, being a Canadian is about something to do with vision in terms of our place in the world. I would say that that question was certainly very foremost in Canadians' minds, leaders among the population, decades ago. Let's say, you know, after the Bandung Conference, during the Trudeau period, and so on. And it's become less so now. Canada is much more aligned, and our wealth is actually a function of the fact that we're part of, you know, we're in a big club. We're in the club of, you know, top dozen richest countries. So we have a lot of fortuitousness in terms of why we're wealthy, too. So we have to keep that in mind. I'm grateful for that. I'm not saying I'm not. I'm grateful for that, right? But we also have to keep in mind that, you know, someone growing up in Calcutta can't get into here because he's poor, right? They have a hassle even trying to immigrate nowadays. It's true that we have multiculturalism in terms of immigration, but increasingly, it's not for my grandfather who came over as a coolie. It's for someone who, you know, can buy $1 million in Vancouver and not even live in the house, right, and just going to wait for it to sell while they make, you know, while they run their businesses in Hong Kong or Shanghai. So I think there's a lot of problems in terms of Canada, and it relates to a kind of precisely the ontological question of who we are, and we don't seem to ask that question so much. I want to make another point, which is that I live in the United States and in Philadelphia, and I meet a lot of very successful Canadians. I'm talking academics everywhere. Even in my city now of Philadelphia, the conductor of the symphony is from Montreal, Yannick Séguin. Director of the Penn Museum is from Toronto or Kingston. Director of the Children's Museum is from Ottawa. That's just three, you know, big positions in the city, and there's many, many more. So that tells me that there's enormous fluidity in terms of what Canada is doing right, in terms of the success stories of Canadians, right? The odd thing is that even though I'm running into, in fact, last week I had dinner with two professors, both from Yale. One was a Russian expert, Russian cinema expert, and came from Fort McMurray. So it's very successful. He learned Russian in his 20s, and now he's like the head of cinema studies at Yale University. And the other was a Chinese woman who spoke with a Chinese accent, but she was a professor of French at Yale, who also learned French during her graduate days and so on. So there's lots of stories like this. So the issue isn't whether, you know, we're just a small country and we don't have a lot of success in terms of, you know, and that's why we need to batten down hatches and, you know, and kind of reprise constantly every day the garrison mentality. There's, you know, success stories are easy to find out there. Right, so, but yet at the same time, I feel that there's also this kind of odd divide between Canadians who don't kind of recognize that, right? And this, I'm not trying to make the argument that somehow, you know, you have to go abroad to find success, and so that's really a boring argument. I'm just saying that there are success stories out there, and we have to kind of recognize that, so, right? I wanted to also make one more point about Canadians as well, which is, I think... one more point related to that, which is that I live in the United States, as I say. There are a lot of problems in terms of the city that's not my home, Philadelphia. And being a Canadian has actually afforded me a real amazing vantage point, which I think is a real privilege and a function of my education, my formation in Canada, which has allowed me to kind of look at my new home as an outsider. And I think that's a real privileged position, to be a kind of outsider, right? But I also feel every time I come back north of the border, I feel like I'm coming home, but I also feel that I'm also an outsider here too, right? And I think that's actually good I and bad. I feel like an outsider increasingly in my hometown, my original hometown of Vancouver. I don't really kind of recognize it anymore. It's become Monte Carlo. It's become kind of this other place that doesn't... it's a lot of good restaurants, so it's not like I bemoan all the changes to it. But I think there's something that's we've become detached in terms of what Bertrand was asking, which is, you know, what does it mean in terms of philosophically, not monetarily, but philosophically, to be a Canadian today and for the future.
Thank you very much. Last but not least, Mary.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon. I just wanted to say a few words in my language, which is Inuktitut. I'm from Kujuak in Nunavik, in the northern part of the province of Quebec, on the Angava coast. So it's a real pleasure for me to share the stage in this conversation with the three gentlemen, Bertrand, John, and Ken, and also to listening to the inspiring words of the mayor from Calgary, Mayor Nenshi. When he showed that sign that said, "We lost some stuff, we gained a community," what I got out of that was that story he told was really talking about people. You know, oftentimes when we talk about governments and organizations, we don't really talk about the fact that it's people that, that are in those organizations and in those governments. And the fact that he recognized that and the enormous amount of effort people make to make things work. We tend to pick on things that don't work, but we also need to remember that there's a lot of things that do work. Today, I mean, the issue of Aboriginal peoples in Canada hasn't been raised yet, but being an Aboriginal person from the Inuit community, I'd like to spend a few minutes talking about it, and because I think it's part of the conversation that we need to have in Canada. I've worked in government, I've worked in communities, I've worked in non-governmental organizations, so I have a sense of the importance of enlisting individuals, communities, and the global civil society in bringing about change. I think we need all those aspects. And the debate and the struggle and the negotiations that Inuit have engaged in over the last 30 years, which I've been involved in, which have culminated in the settlement of our land claims agreements, has been about carving out a relationship with the center of political and economic authority and power, and about regaining pride in ourselves. And I think I can probably say that for other Aboriginal peoples in Canada as well. So in thinking about the process of bringing about change, I think it necessitates a couple of key ingredients. First, I think you must find a way of organizing like-minded people that will work together. So when I think of about the infinite possibilities, for instance, that internet and the social media have provided for organizing like-minded communities and of people, I get excited about it because these useful tools were never available to my generation of leaders, and as well as you know, having been a bit of an activist myself in the early days, we didn't have those available. So throughout the Arctic, I have seen a lot of innovative and creative social media campaigns developed to connect and inform activists, and it is inspiring. For instance, take food security as an example. There was a big issue about food security for a few years ago in the north, not just in Nunavut, but it's there across the Arctic. And we really worked through the social media on this because nobody had funds and resources to travel all over Canada to talk about it, so we used the social media. So these are things that I think are really important. The second key ingredient, I think, in bringing about change is harder to achieve, and that is to create the political space to bring about change. If I look back over the past 40 years, I can say that the emergence of international human rights legislation and the work of the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples and the declaration by the UN, such as the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, have really helped create a political space for Inuit and other Aboriginal peoples that say, okay, we have rights, or you have rights, and we have issues related to our well-being that need to be honored and addressed. I think that conversation needs to continue in Canada as well as with the other conversations that have been highlighted today. And this brings me to what I have now spent the last 6 years focused on almost entirely, and that is education. The need to close gaps in our education systems so more of our youth graduate, and the right to preserve, protect, and promote our languages in our education systems. We researched this for 2 years and came out with a national strategy, which I've been working on, as you see through my title. And I'm really encouraged to discover that there is a growing number of Canadians who also feel that. As a nation, we must, I think, commit to improving outcomes in Aboriginal education. We really feel very strongly about that. And then I'll talk about the, I know I'm probably running out of time here. I just want to speak about this last initiative I'm involved in, which is I was invited by the former Northwest Territories Premier Cackley, to join with Prime Minister Paul Martin, Joe Clark, and other distinguished Canadians, which some are here, in a common cause to strengthen Canada through the creation of a new partnership between Indigenous peoples and other Canadians. And it's called Canadians for a New Partnership, and it was unveiled earlier this month at the Museum of History in Ottawa. And as I said earlier, change comes from like-minded people organizing and working to create a political space to move forward. So I really encourage you to visit the website for Canadians for a New Partnership and read our declaration, because it is a declaration about change and the future of Canada, and that is the focus of our conversation today. So thank you very much.
One of the interesting things that the mayor said was that the government of Canada could disappear and it would take 2 weeks for the rest of us to know about it. I'd like to know what you all think about, well, is he correct? And what role does a national government now play in people's sense of society and social engagement?
Well, for me, one of the things I have to say that, you know, in my experience, and again, you know, I spent a lot of my time trying to, attract very smart people to work with me. And I would agree with the mayor that the city has become a very, very important unit. People relate a lot more in my conversations and trying to convince people to join my project. The question of, you know, will I live in Paris, Toronto, Amsterdam, or New York City has become bigger than which country we live in. However, I think that at the same time, I think that the role of the federal government is to drive leadership, is to drive a vision, is to drive a sense of identity and aspiration that, of course, can be driven at the city level. But I think that the city, as powerful as it is in transforming and driving the future, has limitations in what it can contribute to the world stage.
John? Oh, I disagree. So why not? Let's have some fun. You might have noticed the absence of the federal government after only a week when Pierre Trudeau was Prime Minister, because he was part of a multi-generational effort to get the federal government to mean something to someone somewhere. And we spent an awful lot of time in rooms like this asking ontological questions about what is it that we are as a country? What do we mean? What is our vision? How can we define ourselves other than not as bad as the Americans? And there were a great many conferences like this, and we sat in a great many rooms like this and had a great many discussions like this. Meanwhile, the country just got on with itself. And I think one of the things that has happened has been a blessed withdrawal of the federal government from the faces of its citizens. We saw that starting after the 1995 referendum, when Chrétien devolved significant amount levels of powers to the provincial governments in response to that. And we've seen it accelerated under Stephen Harper, who you will remember wrote the firewall letter saying, what can we do to get the federal government out of our lives, especially out of areas of jurisdiction to which it should not be intruding? And Stephen Harper, the author of the firewall letter, ended up becoming Stephen Harper, the Prime Minister, and he answered his own letter. He said, we'll just get you out of people's lives. So under him, we've had a decade now in which the federal government does not interfere in areas of provincial jurisdiction. It does not initiate new spending programs. It handles the things that the federal government handles, which you can go several weeks without noticing. That includes the post office, by the way. And it has resulted, I think, in, for me, at least from where I sit, a period of calm, the like of which we have never seen since the 1950s. And that while at the same time, the country itself, on its own, without the guidance of elites, is inventing itself and reinventing itself and defining itself and making Vancouver one of the most fabulous cities on earth, making Toronto one of the most fabulous cities on earth, and Montreal as well. So I don't really think we need any of this vision thing. I think everything is just fine. And if it's 3 weeks before you notice the federal government, that would be an improvement.
Okay. Ken, do you want to take it?
I don't think there's a yes or no answer to that. It's both, actually. I think what John's talking about in terms of a kind of diminution in terms of the presence of the government, and certainly in redundant and unnecessary spheres of you know, individual lives, is a good thing. And Canadians, I think still harbor a kind of unhealthy degree of apprehension in terms of that transformation, right? And I think that that's not necessarily a good trait of Canadians not to be more skeptical than they are in terms of government, to be honest. And I believe in a good functioning government. So, you know, I often will say that as an artist, and people, other Canadian artists will say, "How could you say that? You're just some reactionary." And so, but anybody who knows me knows that that's not true. I just think that as an artist, it's incumbent upon us to be skeptical of the government. You know, because that's traditionally been the role of modern artists and so on. Now, I do think that being said, what John says is good. But I also think it's bad in the sense that it's the role of government to kind of see the big picture, right? Offer a kind of vision in terms of where should we be going in terms of spheres of technological investment, infrastructure, those types of things. We're not addressing those. Certainly, it was, I have to say, addressed at one time when we came up with the annex satellites and the idea of Canada would lead in terms of a kind of in advance of even the invention of the internet. In fact, there's a whole kind of theory in terms of academics. There was an alignment between academics on campus, such as McLuhan and even Fry and others, and the industries and smart governments in around the world, from Norway to South Korea, for example. They know how to mobilize and say, okay, this is what we need to do in order to make sure that our kids are educated in the right areas to prepare themselves for the future. So in that sense, I think government is actually not playing sufficiently its proper role.
Mary, anything to add?
Well, I think, John, we could have quite a discussion here.
Same here.
Because I, you know, coming from an Aboriginal background and from the Aboriginal community, it's not about getting the feds out of our lives. It's about getting them engaged so that we can make changes to what the status quo is. And it's about, like, coming from the Arctic where there's no services in terms of a lot of things we take for granted in Montreal or in southern parts of Canada, we need the engagement of governments. I mean, whether it be territorial, federal, provincial, depends on who you are. I mean, the First Nations want to deal directly with the federal government. Inuit are more open in terms of the relationship building we have with the province and the federal government because of the land claims agreements that we've signed, the modern day agreements, which are considered treaties as well. But, you know, there are limitations. So you're talking about many different facets of what governments need to do. And they need to, I agree with Ken, they need to mobilize on certain things. If they don't mobilize, then it's not going to help any one of us. So it's not one or the other. You know, there has to be some. I think a country like Canada needs debates on some very important issues that we're facing. And that's why I'm so excited about this new organization that's called Canadians for a New Partnership, because it's about Canadians and the Aboriginal peoples of Canada and non-Aboriginal peoples. Let's have a discussion and a debate about how we address some of the dark history and leave it behind us. Let's move forward. How do we move forward? You know, everybody talks about the fact that we're at a pivotal point in our history or in our future regarding Aboriginal peoples in Canada. So what is that pivotal point? You know, we need to have that conversation. So I think government has a role, but it's also a nonpartisan organization like Canadians for a New Partnership that has a role. So right. It means us, me and you.
Okay. Our theme is individuals, communities, and global civil society. Now, we have seen tremendous advances in the last couple of decades in technology. It's given individuals untold new opportunities to express themselves, to develop personally. It's given rise to new communities, new community formations at a scale that was inconceivable before. How are these technological developments affecting our notion of civil society, and where is it headed?
Well, one of the things, though, I'd like to go back to what you said before, because
go ahead.
I mean, I woke up this morning and Stephen Harper was not at the UN, you know, to discuss climate change this morning. I think that's a shame. I think that, yes, it's all very nice. As individualistic Canadians, we all think that we can play God and everything will take care of itself. But I think our federal government has a role to play on the world stage to tackle, you know, a very, very significant issue that it cannot be left alone. I think that, so I'll just clarify this before I tackle your question. I think that, you know, the social media, in my opinion, is changing everything, because it creates a torrent of information. The job that you do, the job that great institutions like the Globe and Mail and La Presse and, you know, our national papers and leadership from the St. Lawrence elite, as you called it, used to play, that role has disappeared, and everything has been basically shattered into pieces, and now everybody has become an expert on everything. And everybody, you know, gets around and gets excited about throwing ice buckets on people's head and everything. And personally, I don't, although this is a commendable and there's a positive impact and there are good things that come out of this, I think that, you know, this country still needs, as I said, a strong leadership to tell us, you know, who do we want to be as a collective group of people?
Yeah. Well, I guess the interesting thing within my own argument is that we used to have in the media a number of gatekeepers who played an enormous amount of influence in deciding issues. I remember before I was even a journalist, during the free trade debates, I would get up, I would get the Globe and Mail, I would read the front page, I would turn to Jeffrey Simpson, because Jeffrey Simpson was leading the debate on free trade. That's all gone now. Jeffrey's not. Jeffrey's in the office right next to mine.
He hasn't left the building yet.
But we do have this democratization of ideas. The gatekeepers hold much less influence than they ever had before. Netflix, the institutions themselves are dissolving. This fight, you must have seen this in the paper today. The CRTC hauls Netflix up and says, give us all your information. And Netflix says, go away. And now the CRTC has to decide what it's going to do with Netflix. Is it going to try to rope it under the Broadcasting Act and impose Canadian content on it? But surely we all see what's under threat is not Netflix. What's under threat is the CRTC. That institution's days are numbered, no matter who the next government is, because there is this this broadening out of accesses of information, of access to information, and of instant experts. We don't need elites to tell us who we are. There is a free play of market forces and ideas, and as everything, as well as everything else. And it's not just about buckets of ice over the head. It's about new voices coming up with new ideas that win us over and that excite us. And they are the ones who are going to define us in the future.
Well, Sonny, it just made me think about the internet was invented 2 years after the death of Marshall McLuhan, who was quite prescient in terms of. In terms of the theories of the internet, right? I think with social media the way it is today, it's there's a lot of information that's dispensed to everybody in synchrony, but can be an incredibly unifying force. You know, think about man walking on the moon, right? That was before the internet. Right, and yet, you know, that was just with newspapers. And then to think about the difference between that and then 9/11. So good and bad, it's incredibly unifying in terms of that. And so that tells us something about, what you have to deal with in terms of the question of national identity. Right, there's nothing in terms of national identity is ever going to match this new sense of global citizenship. That's far in excess of anything that you can say is what defines a Canadian, right? But having said that, I do think that being Canadian is still something worth pursuing. My only problem is I don't sense that big question of what are the things that are worth pursuing is actually being asked. There's that's kind of absent nowadays. So I do think that. We really don't think we should be obsessing in terms of, you know, that there's one essence or there's even a composite of essences that make up Canadians, because I don't think there are any. But I do think, sort of like what Northrop Frye believed, which was that, you know, Canadians are, they have stories to tell in terms of their formation being shaped by their sensory environment, right? And their sense of local history. Right, and I think Canadians, by and large, don't work hard enough, to be honest, to kind of read history or even read the history against the grain, to find out about, about what's going on in the world, and I think that's an area where I think government could play a better role.
Mary?
Well, we tend to hear a lot of negative things about Aboriginal peoples and. What's happening in our communities, but there's some good stories too, and I think not enough focus is given to those stories because the media tends to not pick up on those. But I just want to tell you a little quick story that is a very positive story because it has to do with social media. In the Arctic, in four regions of the Arctic, or four Inuit regions, and we have different writing systems that were all introduced by missionaries that went into the Arctic. We have the syllabic system that's written differently depending on where you are. We have the orthography, the Roman orthography, written differently depending on where you are. So you're talking about probably five different kind of distinct writing systems for 55,000 people. So over the last 5 years since I've been working on education, we've been using a lot of social media to talk back and forth, especially with the young people. And the young people have great minds. I mean, they're just so, they explore things. And one of the things that we decided through this education work that I was doing is that we have to unify our writing system as a people in order to have the kind of education system that we want and to be able to educate our kids at a standard that is comparable or equivalent to the Canadian standard, or hopefully it could be better. Who knows? But we can't do that without a unified writing system. We don't want to change the dialects. And people misunderstand that a lot of times, that we're trying to change the dialects of the Inuit language. We're not. We're trying to change the writing system. So through social media, what is emerging, which is really exciting, is that the young people of today that have small kids and families that are sort of not highly educated individuals, but are that are educated enough to go on the internet and the media, so Facebook or whatever, social media, are saying, okay, let's make a decision about our writing system. It's going to happen next year. And I have a feeling, I can't say what it's going to be, but I have a feeling, because the people, the Inuit that are talking on social media are actually speaking Inuktitut, but using the Roman orthography as a way of doing it, because not everybody does syllabics. All Inuit speak Inuktitut, but they don't use syllabics in three of the four regions. So people are using Roman orthography as a way of communicating. So that is shifting the whole conversation in a different way. And I wanted to say that about social media being a positive thing for us.
That's a great, great anecdote, yes. We're here in a university, and you said, Bertrand, nobody's thinking big. No big ideas. Ken said nobody's asking the big questions. What's the role of the university today in building civil society? Is it doing a good job as an institution, or universities as institutions, doing all they could to be promoting civil values?
Well, I think that, you know, the universities in Canada, we have a great education system. I think that, you know, again, you know, because I have the privilege of recruiting people from all over the world, I can tell you that, in my opinion, our education system, especially higher education, is very solid in Canada. But one of the things that, you know, for me, I think is very important to build a strong civil society is a conversation about the future. And I think that, you know, that's true of business, that's true of governance, and that's true of academic institutions as well. I think that, you know, if we're going to rally about something, if we're going to discover big ideas, if we're going to build a common project for humankind, it's by being deeply, deeply passionate about the future.
And so where do you see big ideas coming from now?
Big ideas are come from basically problem solving, by throwing problems at people that are interesting. But I think that what we have to build in everybody around Canada and everywhere around the world is a belief that there is a solution. It's that fundamental optimism that drives creativity. Without a sense of optimism, there's no creativity. We could all go to bed and we could die and sleep. You know, and I think that's what the universities have to foster amongst our youth, is this sense that they can impact the future and that kid problems can be solved.
John?
Yeah, I'm on a leave of absence, as you heard from the Globe this year. I'm down at the Center for International Governance Innovation in Waterloo, which is on the Grand River, which flows into the St. Lawrence, all making it part of the Laurentian Consensus. Now, I'm going to get yelled at this point because I don't know these numbers for sure, but I believe Wilfrid Laurier's enrollment is down 20% this year. So public affairs at Wilfrid Laurier, get on Twitter and correct that number right away. But that's at least I was told. There's the real problem that we're having, that many universities are having right now, is that, again, we're bringing in 250,000 people a year. Every year, we're bringing them in from China and India and the Philippines. Those are the three top intake countries. Parents are aspirational. They have huge ambitions for their children. They want their children to get ahead. And they have not a huge interest in seeing their kids taking a degree that ends in ology. So while computer sciences, while engineering, while the professions are doing well, humanities and social sciences are in trouble. And they're in trouble, I think, especially because, and this is something we have to start thinking about, the social sciences and humanities are in trouble because immigrant Canadians are not interested in them as much as native-born are. And children generally, whether immigrant or native-born, are much more concerned, and rightly so, in a deeply competitive environment, with finding jobs that will allow them to lead good lives and look after their children. So the big challenge for universities right now is going to be justify yourself. Again, in a world where ultimately market forces predominate, even in the academy, justify yourself or explain how you are going to face a future of anything other than relentless and remorseless decline.
I agree with John, but I would reframe it differently. I would say
everyone wants to reframe it differently.
Just to make it more correct. I would say that the younger generation, the young people and so on, they've become far less literary than my generation and those older than me. That's good and bad. It means that literary means they're not reading books. They're reading, but they're not reading books, and which requires a certain type of patience and a certain type of passage of time and commitment, and makes you think differently. And so, and yet the universities were born out of this period where it's structured on the environment, the ambience of the literary, and that's why it's in crisis. There's a kind of non-identity problem, to quote Hegel, between this younger generation who are non-literary, I'm not saying they're not smart or anything, I'm just saying they're non-literary, and then you have this physical environment of the university, which is still very defined in terms of literature. And I think that that needs to somehow resolve itself somehow.
Mary.
Well, universities have worked hard with us, with, I think, Aboriginal peoples in Canada, McGill being one of them for sure, especially with Nunavik at the beginning when we were trying to get our education system in place where we had our own teachers. So there's other universities across the country that have also been very involved, like the legal course in BC that where we had, for the first time, Inuit lawyers, and also PEI, where people graduated from the BSc social program. So there's been a lot of different things happening with us, working with us, and I think we need to encourage that because we don't yet have a university in the Arctic. I think that's the next big project that is on the minds of the younger generation now, is that even though we do have colleges, the Yukon College, the Nunavut College, which used to be Arctic College, and I think they're working towards, being able to grant degrees, but it's still up, pretty much in the works. But as you probably, being from a university, know that when Aboriginal students come to universities, they have a hard time because it's not, they're outside of their comfort zone, basically, out of their own communities, and they're not, used to being with non-Aboriginal students every day. So it's a difficult situation where students end up, going home before they finish or graduate. So the role of university in our civil society is very different from the role of university in sort of the mainstream Canadian civil society. So there's a big distinction there.
We have a question on Twitter about optimism and civil society. And I've sensed on this panel actually quite a bit of optimism despite challenges to national institutions, civic institutions, Laurentian elites. There seems to be a sense that people, as the mayor said, can be trusted to reform and direct their own communities, and that we're actually making some real progress in the realm of civil society. Would you agree with that, Bertrand?
Well, I think that I'm not sure that civil society is progressing at the speed of internet. Is not progressing at the speed of technology. I think that right now, I think that, you know, there are a lot of things that have been disrupted by technology in the last, you know, 30 and 40 years. But I think that that we would, you know, we can argue that civil society is struggling because there's a lot of structure, there's a lot of hardwired things that need to be transformed in the way we organize ourselves. But I think that this, you know, as the world and as technology has changed so many things, I think we can all anticipate a little bit. It goes back to my initial comment about this sense of optimism that, in the end, you know, that the problems, even though they're quite big and they're getting bigger in front of us, can be solved. That science somehow and knowledge, in the end, will take us out of that. I can't say for sure that it's the majority view of all Canadians, but there's certainly, again, in the world that I'm in the world of creativity, there is a deeply rooted belief that all these changes will, in the end, impact civil society as well.
John? Daryl and I say in the Big Shift that we think Canada is the world's most successful country. So I think we're pretty profoundly optimistic. I believe it. Deeply, I don't think there is a society on Earth that has achieved what we have achieved. In a way, it's the result of our failures, as success so often is. Canada never became a nation. Quebec, obviously, the Quebecois are a nation within Canada, but Canada never became a nation. It's a failure as a nation. But it paved the way for us to become a wonderful post-national state. It's the culture of accommodation, as we call it, that makes it possible for us to get along with each other. Bearing in mind that there aren't a lot of us, we're spread out along a very long border, we speak different languages, and right from the get-go, the only way we could make the thing work was to give each other distance, give each other space, give each other respect. That turned out to be a fabulous formula for bringing in millions and millions of immigrants from all around the world. It gives them the space to feel that they belong, to feel that they're respected. And to come up with the exciting ideas, the creativity, the outside-the-box thinking that you're seeing in our major cities now. The country is rebalancing. The rise of the West is all for the good. It creates a powerful new region to counterbalance the center. The cities are the most cosmopolitan places on the planet. And when you look at that, sort of post-national, multicultural, cosmopolitan urban society, how can you not feel optimistic about this country? And if that doesn't work, then just read a copy of The Economist and find out how much worse everyone else is doing compared to us.
Well, I think that as a Canadian citizen, there's lots to be optimistic about, but then we were dealt a good hand. We live in a kind of world peak economy in terms of commodities, and we have a lot of commodities that the rest of the world increasingly needs. And so we're very lucky. And so as a Canadian, it's kind of like we're on the right ship. It's not the one that's sinking.
It's easy to be optimistic.
Right? Yeah, it's easy to be optimistic. Right? But as a citizen of the world, I'm not optimistic. I think, you know, hell's going, you know, alive and well all over the world. It's a disaster. Right? I spent time residing in from Dakar, Senegal, spent a lot of time in West Africa, India, you name it, right? Got sick in some of these places. Did I enjoy it? No, not on a certain level, but do I regret it? No, because it made me really see how lucky we are as Canadians. But that brings me to my point, which is that we cannot just be complacent in terms of feeling how optimistic we are as Canadians. We cannot allow ourselves just to define ourselves as Canadians just within our borders. We have to define our Canadian-ness in relationship to our role as global citizens, right? So I don't think excessive optimism can lead to a kind of hubris, which makes us forget about the other and our relationship to the rest of the world. So that's how I would answer it. I would say, by and large, I'm not optimistic, but, you know, if you were to artificially just kind of define Canada as within the borders, the political borders, there is a lot of optimism.
Mary.
Well, I'm generally an optimistic person, and I do my work in that fashion. But I feel a little bit out of place in this discussion because I think if I'm not representing all the Aboriginal peoples in Canada. I come from the Inuit community, and we have certain challenges in the Inuit community. For instance, you know, we've been talking about how rich this country really is, and what a beautiful place. I mean, I love Canada. I think it's one of the greatest countries in the world. But when you live in a region like the Arctic, and you talk about climate change, for instance, and our Prime Minister is not talking about climate change, we have some very serious adaptation issues facing us in the Arctic right now in regards to climate change. And I, as a leader in my former position as the president of the National Inuit Organization, every time I talked internationally, I talked about the fact that even though we live in a developed country, a rich country like Canada, we really need adaptation measures in the Arctic. But we can't get those adaptation measures because we live in a developed country in a region that compares to a developing country. So there's all these rules and regulations why we can't have access to mitigation and adaptation measures that other regions get around the world. So, you know, that puts a real damper on an issue like climate change for us because it's affecting our people every day. If you want to see change, go to the Arctic on climate change. So it's hard for me to talk about other indigenous or Aboriginal peoples in Canada because take, for instance, the Education Act that just went down the tubes not too long ago. Who's suffering because of that? The kids, the children that should have benefited from that agreement. I'm not blaming it. I'm not going to get into a discussion about who was wrong and who was right, but the victims of that whole process are the children that aren't going to get the education. There was a lot of dollars involved. They're not going to get the education that they so deserve. So optimism is something that, you know, that I think varies from region to region and within peoples in Canada. We said we were at a turning point in the country in relation to Aboriginal issues. I think that's what the young people are saying. Not people like me, necessarily, because I've been through the process and I know what our history is like, but young people are looking to the future for change.
Good. That brings us to the end of our time. I'd like to thank our panel for their very intelligent and interesting comments. We're now going to take a short break of 10 minutes. I invite you to all get up and stretch your legs, and we'll be back here, as I say, 10 minutes. Thank you very much.